to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look back at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. Joining me this month is Joe Neuft. Hey, Joe. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, Blaine. Thanks for having me.
So, Joe and I will be talking about Alfred Hitchcock's underseen 1948 film, Rope, which was based on a play of the same name by Patrick Hamilton. It was written by Arthur Lawrence, and it stars Jimmy Stewart, John Dahl, Farley Granger, and Joan Chandler, among others. Rope tells the story of two young college students, Brandon and Philip, who murder their friend as part of a cold intellectual experiment. They stuff his body in a chest, and then they proceed to host a dinner party serving food and drink on top of that very chest in which his body is contained. It's cheery stuff. So let's dive right into all the cheeriness. Joe, you picked this film, and Rope, It had been years since I had seen Rope, and Rope is one of Hitchcock's more underseen films. So a couple of questions right out of the gate. Why do you think it is one of his more underseen films, and what made you pick this film for this episode?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Rope actually was considered one of Hitchcock's five lost films. The other films in there were The Man Who Knew Too Much, Rear Window, The Trouble with Harry, and Vertigo. But The Man Who Knew Too Much and Rear Window and Vertigo both eventually picked up some popularity and some acclaim. But Rope definitely kind of flew under the radar. And I think a lot of that had to do with it being banned early in its release in a lot of U.S. cities because people thought that it was kind of implying homosexuality with the two main characters of Philip and Brandon. Mm-hmm. So it kind of roots back to just the cultural ideals in America at that time. And when they saw these two characters, two men living together and in a lot of ways acting like they're in a relationship with each other. And Hitchcock always, in all of Hitchcock's films, he always has this dark theme of sexuality mm-hmm. that he uses. And in those times you didn't show very much. You just implemented it through the script, through the conversation, the storytelling. And you can definitely pick up on themes of like that in Rope with the two main characters, with Brandon and Philip. So it didn't get a wide release. A lot of people didn't get to see it upon release. And then, like I said, when it came out later, Hitchcock actually bought back the rights for the film. And basically no one could see it for 30 years. So he saved these five films and dedicated them to his daughter, Patricia. And then eventually, I think it was in 1984, he ended up – or not him, but someone ended up re-releasing them. And they actually went back out in theaters. And that's when like movies like Vertigo kind of picked up more national steam. And now a lot of people think that Vertigo is one of Hitchcock's best films. But yeah, Rope definitely flew under the radar. But it's funny because Rope was the second Hitchcock film I ever saw. So, you know, obviously I didn't know anything about that. So right out of the bat, it was one of my earliest exposures to a Hitchcock film. And I saw it when I was a kid with my mom. I grew up watching Hitchcock films with my mom when I was little. So there's some sentimental reasons behind it. Like it was one of the first Hitchcock films I saw. I really enjoyed it when I saw it. And then in college, I actually took a film class on Hitchcock, and we talked in great depth about Rope. So I think also just feeling like it was a film I could talk about and have some knowledge on was a part of that. But I really like Rope. I think there's some great social commentary in Rope that's still relevant today, if not more relevant today right now in our kind of troubling political climate. And I think Rope is just a really interesting movie because it's, as far as I know, it's the first movie from any director that was attempted to make it look like it was all done in one shot, in one setting. Like you said, Blaine, it was based off a play. So it feels kind of like watching a play, like there's just this one setting and it's all made to look like one shot. It's not, of course, but it was very ambitious for Hitchcock to try that. And most of his films aren't like that. They're very diverse in their settings. So I think Rope is just a very unique Hitchcock film.
For sure. Yeah, I like that you brought up that it was banned in several U.S. cities. And I was reading a little bit about that, and actually on the copy of Rope that I own, there's a little documentary called Rope Unleashed. That's about a 30-minute documentary, very interesting. And they talk a little bit about it being banned, and they talk about the League of Decency, which was actually, run in conjunction with the Catholic Church, and they were responsible for censoring movies, basically. And the League of Decency, of course, wouldn't allow, like you said, any sort of sexual anything to deal with sexuality in any sort of explicit way to be put on screen. And so actually the screenwriter, author Lawrence, says that the entire film is about what he calls it. It's about homosexuality. And he said that everyone knew that the movie was about their homosexual relationship. But of course, nobody could talk about it in Hollywood at that time.
Yeah.
So they would actually use the word it. They would say, you know, we're making a movie about it. So that definitely seemed to be part of it. And then from what other research I could do, it seemed like also it was banned because it's based on an actual murder case that bears some similarities to what we see in the film. I don't know to what extent.
Two students in Chicago or something like that, right? They went to I saw that very briefly, and I didn't do my research on that, but I'm interested. Did you research that a little bit?
Just very, very little, just to know that there was a case and there were some similarities. But that also seems like it could have fed into it being banned in some cities, because the murder was fairly recent at the time this movie was released, so there might have been sensitivity issues or something like that. Those all seem like reasons that it was underseen and underappreciated in its time. But I was really glad you picked this film, because like I said, it had been a long time since I'd seen it, and I was looking forward to revisiting it as an older person, and as someone who appreciates film in very different ways than I did when I was 12 years old and saw it or whatever.
Sure.
And for me, this, I know this will never be, for a lot of critics, one of Hitchcock's higher rated films, but for me, this movie really embodies what Hitchcockian suspense is, as well as almost anything else he does. Because there's this that famous quote where Hitchcock is talking about the difference between surprise and suspense.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about this scenario, this imaginary scenario in a film where you have a bomb under a table, and you could have it where the bomb just goes off and surprises everyone. Or you could create suspense by letting the audience know that the bomb is under the table, showing the anarchist placing it there, I think he says.
Yeah.
And so then the entire time you have a suspenseful situation because the audience knows something that some of the characters don't. And this movie is just a textbook example of that, because we don't have a bomb, but we have a dead body that literally everyone is, you know, talking around and eating off of and all of this stuff. So this really does get at what Hitchcock does so well. It's also what we talk about in some of the literary studies I do as dramatic irony, right? When a character mm-hmm. knows something. And it's a little bit of situational irony when a character knows something that, or when the audience knows something that a character doesn't necessarily. So it's a whole lot of fun. This really is. It's fun in that sense, even though the subject matter is very grotesque.
Yeah.
And Hitchcock has a lot of fun with it. I mean, this movie's packed with tons and tons of double entendres, and mm-hmm. you can tell that Hitchcock was just having a lot of fun experimenting with things. So you mentioned that the movie was also filmed in a set of 10 long takes. They ranged from just under a minute to over 10 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something really innovative, especially for mainstream Hollywood film at the time. So that's one thing that makes this film unique. What else makes Rope unique among Hitchcock's filmography?
Yeah, that's a good question. I like that you mentioned the suspense. I mean, Hitchcock is... If there's anything Hitchcock's known for, it's his ability to depict suspense creatively and also just straight from the textbook. It's funny that you mentioned that, because he actually told the screenwriter who wrote the script, he told him that they were not going to show the scene of Brandon and Philip killing David, which is the first thing you see after the credits roll. And the screenwriter didn't want him to show that because he wanted there, in his mind, he said, I want there to still be the suspense and the mystery of if they actually did it. And of course, Hitchcock just shows it right off the bat. So I think that's unique in a way, because in a lot of Hitchcock movies, you don't get that right off the bat. You don't get that. That's not the first thing you see. I mean, he often does reveal the crime or the inciting incident early on in his films. But in Rope, it was just, if you watch it for the first time and you see that scene, part of you has to wonder, what else can Hitchcock do at this point? Like, what else is there going to be for me to be surprised? And he totally delivers on it throughout the whole film. There's not a boring part in the film where you get dismayed or you have a lack of interest. He definitely keeps you in. I also think it's unique because this is Hitchcock's first color film. So his first time to use that kind of palette. And he actually, I can't remember how many scenes it was. It was a big chunk of the film they had to redo because he didn't like the colors of the sunset, which was a fake sunset out the window. And so it just more area for Hitchcock to employ his perfectionism and his extreme, his extreme sight for detail, and everything had to be perfect. And I think that comes out in his first attempt at a color film. Like you mentioned, he does it in 10 scenes, all to make it look like it was shot in one complete shot. And I think that is something really extraordinary for a film director, filmmaker in that time, because it really does look like it's one shot. Like, you can tell where the cuts are here and there for sure. But if you watch Rope and then go watch Birdman, a lot of the same techniques are employed by Hitchcock that they did in Birdman. And it looks pretty seamless. It flows pretty well. So I think that was an extraordinary feat for him to tackle. And there's actually a story I read about yesterday that they would, because they were filming such long takes, the actors, of course, and everyone on set was trying to do their best to not disrupt the take. And in one scene, the dolly that the camera was on actually rolled over the cameraman's foot and broke his foot. Right. And I'm sure you read it too, Blaine. They had to like drag him off the set.
Yeah.
And they said they basically like gagged the guy and drag him off the set and kept shooting. And I can't imagine that, like, you're shooting a film and you break your foot and they just kind of take you off. Right. And another interesting thing, I don't know if you've seen the trailer for this film. But if you haven't, I would say go take a look at it, because the trailer is essentially a separate movie. Like, it's the beginning of the film. It shows – so David, the man that Brandon and Philip kill in the beginning, is engaged to Janet, who is invited to this party along with a lot of other of David's friends and relatives. And it shows a scene of them in a park basically talking about getting engaged, and David's trying to propose to her and she's saying we should wait till after college. But it ends on a note of these two are in love and they're going to get engaged, but that scene never shows up in the film. Mm-hmm. So it's like
in good 1950s fashion, Jimmy Stewart comes in and voiceover and he's like, that was the last time they saw each other.
Yeah. He just comes in and completely like sits down and tells you a story. And it's almost, it's funny cause the trailer is almost more, scary than the film itself. Like, the trailer frames it to be kind of this more like a psycho, I would say, more like a psycho movie, where it's like there's terror involved and there's yelling and suspense. Like, obviously there's suspense, but then you watch the movie and it's more of a slow burn movie of just really, really developing a story through a well thought out plot. And it doesn't really get intense until, you know, the third act, maybe midway through the second act. So it's funny to watch the trailer, and I would liken it to seeing the trailer for The Village and then going and watching The Village.
Oh yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. Absolutely. There's a quote from Vincent Canby, a film critic, who says, in Rope, Hitchcock is less concerned with the characters and their moral dilemmas than with how they look, sound, and move, and with the overall spectacle of how a perfect crime goes wrong. And I think that quote perfectly captures the way the film feels.
Yeah.
You really can. You can tell that Hitchcock is having a lot of fun and really being self-indulgent in many ways with this film. And I don't use that in a derogatory way. I mean, a lot of times if a director's being self-indulgent, it's annoying. But mm-hmm. with Hitchcock, it's pretty enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to see what Hitchcock is self-indulging in. I feel like most of the film world wants to see that. Mm-hmm. They want to know. And I also think it's interesting, like this, like you mentioned earlier, this film was released in 1948. So, you know, right on the heels of World War II. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially a commentary on social cleansing, which had to have been obviously was a very hot topic. So I think it's a pretty bold move for Hitchcock to come out and make a movie that questions whether there's any good kind of murder right after, you know, right in the middle of Adolf Hitler.
Indeed,
murdering
yeah.
to.
Let's go into that, because you've mentioned that it's very socially relevant even today. So what are some prominent themes or ideas that do stand out to you?
Yeah, and obviously Hitchcock is known for themes in film that if it's suspense in his themes, like they all there's a couple of things that always are in all of his films. And, you know, there's a couple themes that really stand out to me. Like we mentioned earlier, the sexuality being tied to violence and darkness. There's no actual sex scene in Rope or anything that is physical. There's not even a kissing scene, but there's sexual tension, obviously, between Brandon and Philip that we noted earlier. And there's sexual tension between Janet and I believe three men in the movie she was involved with Brandon, David, who was murdered, and Kenneth, one of the friends yeah. that came there. So there's sexual tension between all of them. And I really think that there's a interesting commentary from Hitchcock, not just in this film, but in a lot of his films, where he really has to get creative with that. And I'm more impressed, you know, there's something to be said about the liberty of filmmakers now and how it's great that you can show, you know, you can show what you want to show and, you know, you can go too far with it for sure, but Hitchcock couldn't show what he wanted to show. So he had to do it using undertone techniques and get a lot more creative with it. And I think that it really produces a really neat look on the human desire and human nature and the drive of selfishness behind all these characters' acts. And then you've got this other idea that there's James Stewart's character, Rupert, who comes into the party, was the professor for a lot of these guys in Harvard, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he comes into the party and Brandon wants him there. One of the murderers, Brandon wants him there because he thinks that Rupert's the only guy who can understand why he wants to murder. And Philip doesn't want him there because he also thinks that Rupert is one of the only guys who can understand why they want to murder. So Brandon almost wants to be known as this power hungry murderer. And the other murderer, Philip, is scared of it. So as soon as he commits the act, Philip's terrified of it. But then they get into the setting and they start talking about it, and Rupert's almost word for word explaining why murder should be legal for a certain social group of people, the mm-hmm. social elite, to help for cleansing the world, essentially. And he says he kind of jokes about it, and so you can't really tell if Rupert really believes it or not, because he makes a comment like, just imagine you wouldn't have to wait in line at the movie theater. You could just murder the person in front of you. And so like that case, like it's like, okay, you're joking. But then he makes another comment. Think about how we could solve poverty. And Hitchcock kind of glazes over that. But that is – I mean, that's almost saying let's recreate the Holocaust mm-hmm. and kill every impoverished community in the world. And that's – I mean, that's a heavy, heavy statement. And I think – there's obvious connections to that train of thought and to where we are today in America with, you know, obviously the Black Lives Matter movement, with the LGBTQ community and them gaining civil rights. Obviously with our political climate right now, with our presidential race that we just went through and the immigrants coming from all over the world and from Syria, and how do we deal with accepting people and rejecting people? And I just think that this film kind of tackles that head on. And it's interesting to see, you know, everyone always says history repeats itself, but it's interesting to see, you know, in 1948, they were still talking about the same things that we're continuing to debate about. And I don't really know if I'd say, you know, obviously we've grown a lot as a community, as a culture, but a lot of the same issues still reside. And I think this film is a good talking point on those issues.
Yeah. And I appreciate how you brought up the creativity that directors employed in order to get around the moral codes that you know, that were in place at the time to keep them from showing explicit sexuality or a number of other things. So yeah, they were very creative, and I think it sort of gets at this idea that's especially relevant for Christians. A lot of times we tend to think, or a lot of conversation at least, seems to indicate that something's only wrong to watch, a film's only wrong to watch if it shows said sexual act, right? Usually these conversations revolve around sexuality, right? Yeah. It's only wrong if it actually shows nudity. And of course, a lot of these films, they don't show nudity, but the implication is certainly there and can actually be a lot more unsettling than actually seeing something, at least for me. I think of an example, that sort of from Hitchcock that draws on early cinema. I took an early cinema course, early silent cinema course, way back when, and we had an entire section of the course on sexuality in early silent film. And in film that was done during the time of the Hays Code. And we looked at ways that filmmakers explored issues of sexuality when codes wouldn't allow it, or when social mores wouldn't allow it. And trains were a big part of that. So a lot of times there would be like a train going in a tunnel, and that would sort of be an indication, a cue for the reader or for the viewer that, hey, something's about to go on between this guy and this girl on this train. And so at the end of North by Northwest, you have the two main characters they're in a train, they begin kissing very passionately, so you know what's coming next. And then the very last shot of the film is a train going into a tunnel and all that implies. And so actually I watched that film with my grandparents shortly after I'd taken that course, and so I was sort of primed for train images. And when that happened, I jumped, and my grandparents didn't even notice it. So yeah, these filmmakers are certainly able to communicate things in a very, very subtle way. And it also seems like you mentioned violence is a fetish. And it really is. Like Brandon, there are so many close-ups of Brandon, and he seems like he's just getting sexual pleasure out of the murder. You know, he's doing a lot of heavy breathing and a lot of, when he talks about the murder, also makes you very, very uncomfortable. And it seems especially relevant for a 1948 setting, and also relevant for us now in terms of how we tend to, fetishize violence and violent acts. We can't seem to get enough of violence on screen, but we don't want to talk about sexuality.
Sure.
That seems to be a big thing for Christians as well, right? We're like, sex, no sex on the screen, no nudity, none of this. Violence, it doesn't matter, it's all fake.
Yeah, 300, I'll see the violent parts of 300 and be totally fine, but get that sex scene out of here. I just want the blood in my face.
Yeah, so Hitchcock seems to be sort of poking at people, being like, see, like, I don't know that this is the best thing, that you're fetishizing this violence, but we can't talk about it, or we can't talk about these other certain things. So yeah. Brennan and Philip also, to me, I'm curious to see what you think. They seem like sort of a metaphor, not a perfect metaphor, but a metaphor for a soul torn between good and evil. So you have like devil on one shoulder, angel on the other, because Brandon's a very hardened murderer, or at least he's very convinced in his law of higher beings. But Philip is the tortured soul, even though he is a murderer. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's really interesting. If you notice at the beginning of the film, when they're actually murdering David, Brandon is just kind of holding him, like he's got his hand on his back and his chest. And Philip actually is the guy with, you know, he's holding the rope and he's strangling him. Mm-hmm. So really, the murder, at least from our perspective, from the viewer's perspective, the murder is committed by Philip.
Yeah.
And he is the one who throughout the whole film is feeling an immense amount of guilt and that they shouldn't have done it. And he's the one that's kind of cracking under pressure, who really is the one who kind of adds to the reveal. He gives them away more than Brandon does. And then Brandon is just, he's so hungry for it. It's almost like Brandon wanted just to observe it. Like he wanted to watch someone die. He actually says in the beginning of the movie, he compares the power of taking life to the power of creating life. And I took that more as a, like, this is as close as I can get to being God, not necessarily as making life as being like, oh, I can have a baby with a woman, making life, but like actually orchestrating and creating life. He's like, the closest I can get to that is by taking life, by committing a murder. And I should create this and I should take away life because there's a certain social group of people who just take up space on Earth and they don't belong. And there's definitely a duality between Philip, because you never hear Philip. Philip never says any of that. He never mentions a good reason to murder anybody. He's kind of just there, which makes you wonder why Brandon even wanted him in there. Obviously, there's the implication that they might be lovers or they're, you know, good friends. So they're kind of together on that. But it is an interesting duality between the two of them throughout the film and watching how they interact with it. There's a scene where Rupert is kind of interrogating Philip on what's wrong with him and if he knows where David is. And he's playing the piano because we learn early that Philip is a good piano player and he's trying to make it as a piano player. And as the questions get more intense and more intense and more intense, his piano playing gets faster and faster and faster. And then I can't remember what it is, but Rupert asks him a question that kind of calms him down and the piano, the melody kind of falls back into tune and aligns with what it actually should sound like and calms down more. And then Brandon walks in and is just kind of like, what's going on here? So Brandon's kind of remaining the steady constant throughout the film, constantly putting pieces of the murder, like the evidence from this murder, in plain sight in front of David's father and aunt, and now almost fiance. And Philip is constantly trying to hide everything. And in trying to hide everything, he's making it more obvious. Mm-hmm. So it is like an angel and devil on each shoulder kind of scenario. And, you know, it's so interesting, like after they murder David, what kind of, you alluded to this earlier, Blaine, but after they murder David, Brandon lights a cigarette and it, like, that scene alone, it's like, this is a sex scene. Like, yeah. That's what happens in film after sex. And then Brandon goes to turn the light on and Philip says, can we just keep the light on for a little bit longer? We don't need to move right now. And then Philip later asks him, like, how did you feel while doing it? It's like they're talking about committing a sin, but it sounds like committing a sexual sin.
Yeah, there's also a line where Brandon, I think, says, it's a shame we couldn't have done it with the blinds open. Of course, he's talking about murder, but the double meaning is there.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of Freudian stuff in this film. And, of course, with Hitchcock just having a blast with this, like, he doesn't let that fly under the surface either. I mean, Janet, there's a line where Janet says, Freud says there's a reason for everything. Rupert mentions Freud when he leaves his cigarette case behind intentionally.
Yeah.
So I think the thing that's really interesting about that is all of the Freudian subtext in this film gets at the idea that, like Freud said, if we repress things, right, ultimately that stuff needs to come out. I think that's an interesting thing to think about as Christians, because ultimately, like, repression is not a healthy way. And this movie shows that repression is not a healthy way to deal with things, right? We need to be able to confess things. So Philip is the character who really, really, really wants to confess. So I think as Christians and as a Christian viewer, one thing that got my wheels turning is I'm very thankful that as Christians, we have someone we can confess to. And I think that's something
I like that.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I like that you bring that up, because while all that's going on with Philip and Brandon, this stifling of, you know, they can't confess, Brandon doesn't want to confess. Philip does want to confess, but both of them can't confess. In the background, there's an interesting kind of second story going on with Kenneth and Janet, who were former lovers. And, you know, I think Kenneth broke up with Janet or something like that. But they're both feeling very awkward that they're there together. And it even frames the film to show that, you know, maybe Brandon has just set this up to get those two back together. And I think the party guests start to, like Rupert especially, starts to believe that Brandon's just trying to screw David over in his relationship with Janet. But while all this is going on, and Rupert starts to get on the, you know, starts to sniff on the trail a little bit that maybe Brandon and Philip murdered David or did something with David. In the background, Janet and Kenneth are having this like strange revival of a relationship because they're being forced. They're in a room together in kind of this prison where somebody that they both have a strange relationship with is missing and they don't know if he's in harm or not. So they're just stuck with each other and they're forced to kind of talk about their differences. There's one extended scene where they're talking about like why things went wrong in their relationship. Mm-hmm. And they essentially, I don't think they actually say sorry, but they essentially confess to each other and say sorry and become friends again. And it's not even in the way that they're going to get back together or start a new relationship. Because eventually they leave the party to go look for David together. So it's not, it's such a pure confession and a pure rejuvenation of relationship that's that kind of, I saw that as an interesting duality in the film as well, where we're having Brandon and Philip struggle and they can't confess anything. But then in the background, there's this other couple who's in the same situation, obviously not the same situation, but a similar situation where they're just forced and they have to, and the freedom that comes from that. And they actually get to leave the room. They get permission to leave the setting where Brandon and Philip, they're stuck in the prison they created for themselves because they can't confess.
That's good. Yeah, that's really insightful. I had not thought about that. That's really good. Anything else you want to bring up as far as what this film gets at socially or thematically?
Yeah, I mean, I think just the biggest things for me are what you talked about with confession, what we just talked about with the two different relationships going on there, and then just the idea of the social cleansing. And I think it's stunning. If you haven't seen the film, you really should watch it, and especially the part where they talk about murdering could be good and social cleansing. And I would challenge you to really analyze what's going on in your brain, because anyone can hear that and say, yeah, that's obviously completely wacky and we shouldn't even entertain the idea. But I think anyone who listens to that probably hears that, and part of you probably thinks like, well, there's some merit to it. He's right. Like if we got rid of all these problems, then they could potentially just not exist anymore. So there's some thought about it. And Rupert is the smart professor kind of engaging with it and saying, yes, this is right. But in the whole time that that's going on, David's father is getting increasingly uncomfortable with the conversation and just saying, this isn't funny, we shouldn't even talk about this, and kind of brings you back to reality. And then at the end of the film, when Rupert finally finds out that Brandon and Philip did in fact kill David, Brandon essentially tells Rupert, we've talked about this, you believe in this, this is your theology, or not theology, but ideology coming into reality here. And Rupert has this moment of just like increased humility and shame. And he's essentially tells him like, you're right. You're right. This is what I've always wanted. And then he kind of thanks Brandon. He says, I thank you because you've made me ashamed and I'm grateful for that shame. But what you did was wrong. And I now know that. So I think there's a good underlying theme that our culture and society could take with, you know, it would be easier to get rid of all our issues, not just with people and politics, but issues in general. It would be easier to get rid of all them and just to wipe them away and ignore them. But there's a lot of merit to having to actually work and struggle through those, and to having to, you know, fail through those. And especially in our social, economical climate that we're in right now, to actually struggle through the idea of thinking about what it means to love and care for others who are not the same race or the same of the same political background or same ethnicity or same sexuality? Like, what does it look like to actually care and love for those people and then to fail doing it and then to feel hurt because you feel let down in the midst of doing that? I think Rope is just a really good almost sermon on how to process life's events like that. Mm-hmm. So I might be going a little too deep into it, but
no,
I would encourage people to see it for that reason.
Absolutely. So let's do something a little different. I've never done this on the show before, but it's something I want to try because often I'll watch a film and then I want to see another film that deals with a similar theme or an idea or maybe looks or feels the same. So we're going to do sort of a rewind double feature, and we'll do this from time to time on the show. If you enjoy it, I guess if I get a bunch of people commenting saying that was terrible, we won't do it, but but we're going to give it a shot. So, Joe, if you had to pick a film to pair with Rope as a double feature, what would it be? Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I would pick 2001's Tape, directed by Richard Linklater. It's starring Ethan Hawke, which of course it is because Richard Linklater and Ethan Hawke are best buds. And then it's got Uma Thurman in it. And I mean, it's a very similar film to Rope. So it's made to look like one shot or a few shots, and it takes place all in one room. Like Rope, they're not locked in the room. So there's, I can't remember what it was called, but there was a movie with Ryan Reynolds where he was like stuck in a casket. And maybe it was called Buried. I think it was called Buried. It was awful. So don't see that movie, but Buried, we're buried in some other films where the protagonists are stuck in a room differ from Rope or Tape is that they're actually in Buried in these other movies. They're actually stuck. They're locked in there. But in Rope and Tape, like they have the freedom to leave. Neither of the characters in both of these films are literally locked in their rooms, but something keeps them in, kind of like what you were saying earlier, Blaine, like there's something that's holding them in this prison that they've created for themselves. And essentially the storyline in Tape is these two old high school buddies reunite in this kind of trashy motel. And one of them is essentially trying to draw out a sin of the other to rectify and to seek vengeance kind of on that man. But they're both really good movies. This Tape, I mean, has to have been influenced by Rope. They're so similar that I would be surprised. I was doing some research on it, and I couldn't find any comparison articles or any critics that were writing up comparisons. But I would be surprised if you asked Richard Linklater, hey, did you get influenced by Rope? But if he said no, I'd be very surprised. Both of them are based off of plays, and both of them are one-word household objects as far as their title names go, Tape and Rope, except obviously Tape is referring to film. But so –
that sounds like a great recommendation. I have not seen Tape, and I'm a Linklater fan, so I will definitely check that out.
Yeah,
my pick is something that's quite a bit different from Rope. It doesn't have the single setting. It doesn't feel like a play, but it's still dealing with issues of repressed guilt. It's dealing with a crime that has been committed. And so there's some thematic connections there, even though it feels very different. And my pick is Eric Schoenberg's 1997 film Insomnia, which is the basis for the Christopher Nolan remake. The original, in my opinion, is much better than what Christopher Nolan turned out. So I am talking about the original 1997 Swedish film, or Norwegian film, Insomnia. It's about an investigator who makes a mistake that sort of leads him to being caught up in a conspiracy of sorts, and he's struggling with issues, like I said, of guilt and innocence. I won't really spoil much more there. The film's original tagline was "He who sins never sleeps," and so actually the environment in which the film, I guess one other connecting point is that the set and the environment in which the setting of Rope is so crucial to the film. The setting of Insomnia is also a very important part of the film because they're in a 24-hour day cycle, and so he literally can't sleep. It's day all the time. He's being plagued by this guilt. So check out Insomnia and check out Tape.
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. I haven't seen the original, but from what I saw of Christopher Nolan's, that's a good. I like your train of thought there.
Cool. I was not sure about that. I was like, man, I don't know. This seems, but yeah, Insomnia is a good film. So that about does it for this episode of Real World Rewind. Joe, it was really great having you. You brought up some great points, and it was good conversation. So thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you take a second to plug yourself and the work that you do?
Yeah, like Blaine said earlier, my name's Joe Noft. If you wanted to follow me on Twitter, you can. It's just my name, Joe Noft, Nooft, all no spaces or anything. There's not a whole lot going on there other than movie talk and basketball talk, so you can check that out if you want to. I write every once in a while for a group called Mockingbird. You can find them at mbird.com. And then I've written a little bit for Real World Theology, and then I've got a little bit going on with Christ and Pop Culture. So I would say check out all those mediums and give them a look, because they've got some really good content going on. And go see Rope. It's a great movie.
Absolutely. It's funny. I don't know that I've plugged Mockingbird a ton on the show, and I should, because Mockingbird is a great site. I actually started reading Blake Collier's work, who we both know. That's sort of how we met. I started reading Blake Collier's work before I knew him in real life on Mockingbird. So yeah, Mockingbird has a ton of great stuff. They don't write exclusively on film either. So you get lots of good. They have a lot of good music people writing there. Lots of good people writing on literature. So yeah, check out Mockingbird. I do have a couple of announcements before we go. First, as many of you probably already know and are tired of hearing about, my fellow Real World Theology staff member Joshua Crabb and I have started our very own Star Wars podcast, because we're nerds. It's called Home One Radio, and every week we dive deep into the stories and characters from a galaxy far, far away. So if that interests you at all, you can find us on iTunes under Home One Radio. Make sure you spell out the word one. And you can also find us at homeoneradio.com. Also, this month marks the one-year anniversary of Real World Rewind. We've been around for a year now. So I would like to thank all of our listeners who make this show possible. It's been a really fun journey, and I'm looking forward to what's to come. So until next time, I would like to thank you once again for rewinding with us. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Hey!